So thank you for the introduction. It's my great pleasure to be able to give a talk here at Parameter. So the title of today's talk is Aspects of Information in Classical and Quantum Neural Networks. It will basically cover the two projects I did last year about machine learning. So this seminar is in this Condensed Matter and Machine Learning Initiative. So let's start by talking about these two fields. So obviously, in the last several decades, these two fields are influencing each other. Traditionally, I think this influence goes from condensed matter physics to machine learning, where we have this classical idea of Hopfield network and Boltzmann machine became probably the first neural network models. While in the last several years, we have seen a trend that the state of the art machine learning ideas and models have been influencing condensed matter physics. We have seen neural network states, tomography, face recognition, and there are also QMC speedup and a lot of stuff are going on. So today I'm going to talk about both directions because there are two works. And both works are bridged by the information theory, which is a kind of a universal theory that is useful both in computer science and physics. So the first part is we are going to use mutual information, use this as a media to use the methods and principles in condensed matter physics to understand machine learning models. So this is the subtitle of this part is why are recurrent neural networks not good at natural language processing? So it's based on this work. I put it on archive. So let's start with sequence generation. Give you guys some machine learning background. So sequence modeling is obviously a very important part of modern machine learning. You generate a lot of data sets can be seen as sequences. And sequence modeling is useful in speech generation, machine translation, music generation, text summarization, and you name it. So in generating this sequence, at least one way to modeling sequence, and I think it's the most common way, is we need to first come up with a probabilistic model for the sequences. We need to assign a probability to all kind of possible sequences. And we sample this probability distribution. So how do you sample a probability distribution? So one way, I think, is also the most common way to do is to use the definition of conditional distributions, where you factorize this general distribution into the product of conditional distributions. In this way, you can just sample character by character or symbol by symbol of this sequence. And essentially, all these different machine learning sequence models use a different parameterization for this conditional distribution. There are several examples. For example, the n-gram model, where we basically model this conditional distribution as a table. And we have here the in principle, this conditional distribution should be conditioned on all the history of the character symbols in the sequence. But because the vocabulary will be very large, and as the sequence becomes longer and longer, this table will become exponentially large. So in n-gram model, we cut off this dependence up to the last n elements. So there are also recurrent neural networks, which were very popular, at least in the last several years, where we model this conditional distribution using a neural network where there is an implicit dependence on the full history of the sequence. We will come back to this, the detail of recurrent neural networks a little bit later. So also, probably in the last 3 years, there are also self-attentional models where we have explicit dependence on the full sequence of this conditional distribution. We'll also say this a little bit later. So when you have a machine learning model, you basically have a parameterization of this conditional distribution, and it basically restricts the possible form of this this joint distribution. And how can you diagnose the expressive power? So one way to one approach or one perspective to understand the statistical property of a sequence is through mutual information. So in case you are not familiar, mutual information essentially is a, in my understanding, is a nonlinear version of correlation function. So x and y are two random variables, and these two random variables are independent only if and only if the mutual information between them is zero. And one major advantage of mutual information compared with correlation function is that in correlation function, you need to multiply two things together, but you can't do that for symbols. But here, mutual information is pretty general, so you can mutual information well defined. Even your sequence is symbolic, and of course, it can capture dependence beyond linear dependence. And if we assume your random process or your this sequence model is stationary or time translation invariant, this mutual information only depends on the time distance of the symbols in your sequence. It's just like a correlation function in your one-dimensional translation invariant system. So one very simple example is the mutual information in Markov models, Markov process. So the simplest model, or you can see this a 1 gram model, a 2 gram model, depending on definition, in our previous example. So basically, we forget all the history of the sequence, and when we sample the next symbol, we only condition on the current state. So it's basically a Markov process. So in order to fully describe a Markov process, we only need this transition matrix. It's a very common, random process, especially in physics. So it turns out you can compute the correlation function or mutual information for a Markovian process. And the mutual information decays exponentially for Markov process. And the exponent is the second largest eigenvalue of the transition matrix. This is a well-known result, probably at least 30 years ago. So this tells you a corollary of this result is n-gram models and hidden Markov models they have an exponentially decaying mutual information. This is something we know because, I mean, intuitively it's reasonable because you have a finite memory. However, probably in the 1990s, a lot of statisticians or I don't know data scientists have they gathered data sets and computed the mutual information scaling. They estimate this mutual information in natural sequences. So it turns out whatever it's the music, whether it's Bach or English text or even human genomes, they basically estimate the mutual information on this data set. You can compute it. Yes?
You've got two lines there, both saying that they're the critical 2D icing model. Am I right in thinking the lower one should be non-critical 2D icing model?
It's still critical, I guess. I mean,
it's got two different values, and everything, almost everything, is in between them.
So I guess the important thing is the slope. So because it's a log-log plot, so this this intercept is this constant factor.
So do those correspond to different phase transitions?
I think it's the same 2D icing model, probably different microscopic details. This is the figure I took from this paper. I'm not sure why they took this.
In the original paper, because you can't have two different things having two different values and have it make any sense at all.
I mean, as long as the exponent is the same, I think it's fine. Where am I? So yeah, you have a vocabulary, and you evaluate the mutual information, how information decay with the distance between the symbols on your sequence, and all these texts, all these data sets, the decay is parallel. So I think the reason, the origin of this power law is still, I think it's still an open question. But nevertheless, this tells us Markov chain-based models, such as n-gram models and hidden Markov models, cannot capture long-range power law dependence in natural sequences. For example, natural language texts. So probably this is one of the main reasons why despite the fact we have hidden Markov models for a long time, their application in natural language processing never really took off. So actually, there is a deep connection of this result with respect to Van Hoff's theorem in statistical physics. So in 1D, statistical physics systems with short-range interactions cannot have finite temperature phase transition. Therefore, correlation and mutual information always decay exponentially at finite temperature. This result is something we know since the time of Landau. And actually, you can map any Markov chain model to a short-range interacted icing model. So here is an example of a method to sample a 1D icing model with open boundary condition, half open boundary condition. So if you want to sample the equilibrium distribution of this, the simplest model, perhaps the simplest model in statistical mechanics, you can actually sample the spin one by one. So from left to right. And it turns out conditioned on all the history of your spin, on the left side of the chain, it turns out it only depends on the spin besides him. So so you can actually sample this Boltzmann distribution conditionally one by one. So this is consistent with the fact that Markov processes are always off critical. Essentially, every 1-2 gram model with vocabulary size 2 can be is essentially a icing model, 1D icing model. So so I think you can understand the fact that the theorem we mentioned before, that a Markov model, this Markov chain models are always exponential decay mutual information as a result of this fact.
So is it not because consider just short range
induction
to the spins?
You can try to generalize this calculation to, like, instead of only nearest neighbor interaction, you can also include next nearest neighbor interaction. Actually, it becomes much harder if you really derive it. It's you will see you can still sample it conditionally, but the function form is very complicated.
Yeah, but then I expect that independence is not just going to be like the proof of state, right?
So, sorry.
I guess, say for example, I have an all-to-all connectivity. So I expect that I will not be able to break my conditional probability distribution with just independence of
It's hard to say because you are marginalizing everything you are not observing. This marginalization, it's hard to tell whether it is easy to do or not. So despite the fact that this icing model is nearest neighbor interacted, this fact is actually not that trivial because the spin at t site, it interacted not only with the t minus one side, it also interacts with t plus one side. So in some sense, it interacts with both past and future. If you see the space direction as the time direction. So so the fact that this icing model is short range interaction alone cannot give you this fact. Actually, you also need to use the D2 symmetry in this model in order to derive this fact. It's kind of complicated. Because here, if you sample it conditionally, you sample from past to the, you only condition on the past. But interaction is always in a physical system. It always the spin always interacts with the left side and the right side. It doesn't only interact with the past. So it's a subtle difference here. So the question is. Okay, what is the mutual information scaling for RNNs? So is it fundamentally better than Markov models? I mean, in the end, people use it all the time, at least before 2017. So so there are different versions of recurrent neural networks. So let's first focus on the vanilla, the first simplest recurrent neural network. So basically, it maintains a hidden state. And at every time step, you update your hidden state. And you can generate an output based on hidden state. And in the next time step, you have a new input. And update your hidden state, generate output. It's what you do. So let's skip this slide. Why RNNs? So so let us first consider linear recurrent neural networks, which probably the only thing you can compute theoretically for a neural network. So we consider a recurrent neural networks, and where the activation function here is linear. So every time step, the hidden state is updated according to this equation. It depends on the input of this step and the hidden state of the last step. So basically, all the memory of the sequence is encoded in this vector ht. And every time step, you sample a Gaussian output based on your hidden state. And this is the output. The input, this sampled output will serve as input in the next time step. So you will actually connect these two vectors. This is what people usually do in sixth generation. So you can actually integrate out hidden states by doing substitution over and over again. And it turns out the output actually depends on the entire history of the sequence, which is expected because, I mean, in the end, ht is updated based on the every input in your sequence. However, you notice that at least in this linear RNN here, you actually multiply this UH, this matrix, t times for the t step input, the input in the t step. So his observation is actually there is an exponential dependence on sequence history. So recall this one Hopf theorem that tells you there is no finite temperature phase transition in 1D short-range models. So physically, exponentially decay interaction is still short-range interaction. So although strictly speaking, the interaction range is infinite, but it is always within the same universality class as the finite range model. So if you believe this Van Hove picture of this understanding of this Markov models, you should expect that actually for at least for linear RNs, the mutual informations should still decay exponentially. So you can actually prove this fact using the using mathematical tools. And so there's a theorem. The mutual information in the linear Elman RN with Gaussian output decays exponentially with time tau. If the RN does not simply memorize initial distribution. So there's some trivial examples that it can generate the same thing over and over again where the mutual information does not decay. But other than that, the mutual information must decay. So I don't have time to present the proof, but you can see the full proof in my paper, like 3 or 4 pages. So yep.
Is there any relation to the fact that most MDS in 1D have exponentially decaying correlations? Or are they both just kind of related to the transfer matrix roughly?
Yeah, I think so. So I think after I finish the proof, I think I know that the random process described by this is called some autoregressive process. I think it is probably well known to people that everything decays exponentially in this kind of random process. I think they are all related, at least mathematically. So so we know that for linear RNNs, the mutual information decays exponentially. So what about nonlinear RNNs? The RNNs we actually use in real life. So I can't compute that with nonlinear activation function, but I can do experiments. So so we test this very simple Ising-like data set, which basically we have a sequence, 0-1 sequence, like spin up, spin down. And then their mutual information decays in parallel. And we train recurrent neural networks to on this data set and generate the same sequence with the trained model. And then we estimate the mutual information on the trained data set. Basically, we see whether the model can actually learn the mutual information. So it turns out for vanilla RNNs, the RNNs we proved before with nonlinear activation function, mutual information actually decays exponentially. If you see it in the semi-log plot, it's a perfect straight line. So even if you have a nonlinear activation function, it won't help. And what about RSTMs?
So what do you call 8 times 2? 8 times 2?
It basically different architectures of the recurrent neural network, because the hidden state can have different size, and you can have different layers of in these recurrent neural networks. So this experiment basically tells you it's actually something fundamental. Increasing the nonlinear layers or increasing the size of the hidden state won't help you. It will improve your the mutual information, the absolute value, but it won't prove the scaling behavior. This is.
So what happens when the two dimensions becomes almost equivalent, like becoming 2D kind of?
Probably we'll talk about what is a 2D network in the self-attention models later. Yeah. So what about RSTMs? So RSTM is basically a more sophisticated version of the vanilla RNA, it has this kind of all different gated structures. But RSTM share the same vital signature with vanilla RNA. It's basically all the history of your state is encoded in one or two hidden vectors. So still the you have a different microscopic mechanism, but everything is still encoded in H.
But don't LSTMs have an explicit forget gate that cuts you off at some time?
Yeah, but
it doesn't have to.
Yeah, but it
exponentially poor in terms of.
But if you explicitly forget the past, it actually should make your correlation decays even faster, not better. So we basically have a long memory and a short memory, CNH. But intuitively, I think they are just no essential difference with RN. Yes?
Just a question. I don't know, maybe you get into that in the slide or something. So what is the K mutual information rate for self-attention neural network?
We will talk about it later.
You will? Okay.
Yeah, I will. Yep, so it turns out with all these sophisticated mechanisms, and actually the fact that RSTM has two hidden states instead of one, so it actually performs much better than vanilla RNNs. But still, it is very clear in small RSTMs that the mutual formation and long range behaviors still are exponential decay. And you can actually. And then I also try the thing. This is another thing. So even if the mutual information decays exponentially with the distance, one can ask how does this correlation length scale with the depth or the width of your network? If that scales very fast, probably. This fact doesn't really matter in practice because I mean, if I can only just by because I mean in the end your data set has a typical length scale, say 10,000 characters. If by simply adding like 10 neurons or two layers, I can boost the correlation length to that length. So it really doesn't matter at long length scale. Whether the sequence decays, whether the mutual information decays exponentially or in parallel. Because the beginning of an exponential decay is also very slow. I can always fit a parallel decay with the early part of the exponential decay. So, so it is important to test how does the correlation length, scale with the width and the depth of the network. So it turns out the correlation length scales with logarithmic of the width. So basically, in order to increase the correlation length by one, you actually need to double your width of your hidden state. So it is very ineffective. The width of your network grows exponentially fast if you want to boost your correlation length. And the depth dependence is actually even worse. So for RNs, it is actually well known that using deep RNs is actually ineffective. For whatever reasons, but empirically, people find that increasing the depth of your network can actually make your performance worse. I think this is most likely due to training reasons, not the architecture reasons. But nevertheless, according to experiment results, you actually cannot boost the correlation length by making your network deeper. So from the scaling point of view, we are kind of doomed. you cannot basically boost the correlation length by simply increasing the width and depth of the network. So I will go through this part really quick. So I also tried the same experiment on not the artificial data set, but the actual natural language data set, this Wikitext. It contains the high quality English Wikipedia articles. And we can see that on the data set, there is a parallel decay of mutual information in this data set. And actually, the result is that the RSTMs can only capture the short range mutual information behavior and cannot capture the power law long range behavior of on this data set. Okay. So I think the up to now, the message I want to convey is recurrent neural networks are simply not good at natural language processing because the model is in the same universality class as a Markov model, despite the fact you have a hidden state that can do that has a implicit dependence over the sequence, but that dependence is simply too weak. I think adding nonlinearity won't change the universality class, although I cannot prove it. But the experiment at least supports this speculation. Okay, then you ask the question: how can you get over with this restriction? I mean, this claim is pretty strong. It's Van't Hoff theorem. So, but actually, in 1D statistical physics systems with long-range interaction, for example, Auto-Hall interaction, power law decay interactions can have finite temperature phase transition. A prime example is the power law Ising model, where the interaction strength decays in power law. And it turns out, as long as the alpha, this exponent, is smaller than 2, you will have some finite temperature phase transition. And they may be in different universality class, depends on alpha. So the idea is, as long as we make the long-range interaction strong, we can overcome this Van't Hoff theorem. So here comes the self-attentional models. It's even more complicated than RSTM, but the main idea is that in recurrent neural networks, the output only depends on the hidden state, but in self-attentional networks, the output at this time step actually depends all the history explicitly. So you actually have a very strong interaction, explicit auto interaction with the past, with the left side of your sequence. So one of the most famous models with this mechanism is called transformer. It was proposed by Google in 2017 and is basically the state of the art. Even to date, people are using this model or the variation of this model. So turns out nonlinearity is essential in this model in some sense. So I can't perform analytical calculation, even in the linear case. So I did some experiments on transformers on the two data sets I just mentioned. So actually, first is this artificial binary data set with parallel mutual information. This is the performance comparison between RSTM and transformer. You can see transformers can actually capture this parallel decay very well. It's almost captured this decay perfectly, as long as your network is not too small. And the same thing goes on the same thing happens in the natural language data sets. And the transformer model can actually also capture the mutual information decay behavior much longer than the median distance. It still has, in my experiment, it still has some difficulty in capturing the very long-range power law decay behavior, But I think that is mainly due to the reason of this data set. So the reason is I actually tried the same thing on a much larger data set, this, and using the state of the art model, actually published by OpenAI. It is a very huge attention model trained on an even larger data set. So this is the mutual information estimate on that on the training set. And you can see, you can also see a very clear power law decay behavior. And this is this is not the training set. This is actually the motion information generated by this very very sophisticated attention model. You can see a very clear power law behavior. And actually, this power law behavior is very closely related to the quality of the text. So in the appendix of my paper, you can see when your mutual information is decays very fast, the text generated by the network is basically unreadable. And when it decays slow enough but still exponential, it basically can spell the words right, but the sentence doesn't make sense. So for this, the best model we have, where you have a very clear power law behavior in your mutual information. Actually, the whole paragraph has a coherent meaning. So
so do you expect a transformer to be harder to train because it's capturing more long range correlations?
It's harder in the sense it's slower to train because it's every time step it is conditioned on the past.
So is it slower in a polynomial way, or is it slower in an exponential way?
Slowing in a polynomial way.
How do you know?
At least the back propagation is slowing a polynomial way, that algorithm. But I mean, if you want to say the actual optimization, that is something I don't know.
Yes, I had a similar question. Don't you have a lot more parameters when you have this explicit dependence on paths? Like, how are you comparing to the RNN?
Yeah, so actually, it's a good question. I think because the fact that the architecture is fundamentally different, mm-hmm. I don't think it makes too much sense to compare number of parameters.
Yeah.
Actually, the transformer has, even the largest RSTM is worse than intermediate sized transformer. And that transformer has an order of magnitude smaller number of parameters in RSTM. So if you actually want to compare the number of, so the architecture is sophisticated does not mean there are more parameters. Every part of this, every component of this part can be small. So they're actually not big. So in other words, in the sense of the efficiency of per parameter transformer is much better than RSTM, if this is something you care about. Yes?
Have you tried to look at mutual information as function of the training?
No, I did not try it. I basically train several models and pick the best one. This is what I do. Yep, so let's wrap up the first part. So to summarize, so there is a correspondence between machine learning sequence model, the interaction strength in the corresponding statistical physics model, and the behavior of the mutual information scaling. So for n-gram model and HMM, these Markovian models, the interaction strength is finite ranged, and mutual information scaling is exponential. For RN, interaction strength is exponential, but it is in the same universality class as this HMM, this Markovian models. So it also produces exponential mutual information scaling. However, for self-attentional models, and perhaps RNs with memory, this is something I did not try. Interaction strength is actually can be power law, even interaction strength can even non-decaying, like a mean field model. So motion information scaling can be either can be exponential and parallel, depends on the how the model is trained. So this is the first part of my talk. So let's go into the second part. So the second part is using the ideas in machine learning to diagnose something in quantum physics. So the media is not mutual information, but tripartite information. It's an idea that is proposed first by a condensed matter physicist. So it's based on this work. I collaborated with some scientists in.
Before you start the second part,
yep.
I can ask you a question.
Sure.
When you prove your proof, you said that it works for linear activation functions, but not for non-linear activation functions. Where does it break down?
This is a like very kind of technical. The first step breaks down actually. In the proof, if it's linear, you can actually integrate out the hidden states.
Yeah.
Very explicitly, very simple. So output is simply this. So if it's nonlinear, you can't do this. You won't have a very nice direct multiplication of several matrices. It will be a multiplication passed through a nonlinear function, a multiplication passed through a nonlinear function. It's simply not the same. So then you don't know how to do all this Gaussian stuff in the proof in a nonlinear function. It's basically a Gaussian process. We use techniques in Gaussian process to prove the theorem. So the object we want to study is the quantum neural network. I actually don't know what does quantum neural network actually mean, but here I actually mean a parametrized quantum circuit of this kind of architecture. So you have some qubit, and we have this pass through a lot of two qubit gates, and the two qubit gates are organized alternatively. So this is basically a parametrized as every this break is parametrized as SU4 or SO4. So we have some input states. And if you see this a network, you can probably want to train this network to prepare some states. You can do that. Probably you can also probably want to extract some information from this this state, and at the end of the day, you want to do a measurement and read out one classical bit of information. Whatever you want to do, this is basically the architecture of a so-called quantum neural network. And a fundamental difference between classical and the quantum neural network, or at least the quantum neural network in this sense, is that everything in quantum circuit is unitary. So back in classical neural networks, after you do a matrix multiplication, this matrix, in most of times, is rectangular. And even if it's a square matrix, it is not invertible. So actually, when the information passes through your network, you every time you pass through something in your network, information actually is lost. So the information is not preserved. So this is why it makes sense to compute the mutual information. Otherwise, the mutual information is always maximal. It does not decay. But in quantum neural networks, everything is unitary. So mutual information, if you still want to diagonize the mutual information, it is always maximal. And it's very trivial in quantum neural networks. So this is not a mutual information itself is not a good quantity to see in quantum neural network. But what makes quantum special is this quantum entanglement. So there is a concept that is very closely related to mutual information. It's called the tripartite information. So So basically, you tri-body information is basically some addition and subtraction of several mutual informations. So here, let's say this is the tri-party information of I3, ACD. So this quantity basically quantifies how much quantity information is spread from area A to C and D by this unitary. So information needs to information of A needs to go into both C and D in order to have this non-zero tri-party information. It is a quantity that quantifies how information is scrambled in your by this unitary. So for example, if your unitary is an identity unitary, so if it's identity, all the quantum information in A goes straight to C. So there's nothing goes into area D. So nothing is scrambled. I3 is zero. So on the other limit, where this U is sampled from an ensemble of uniform hard random unitaries, actually, there is no way you can get any information of A by doing local measurements in C or D alone. So in that case, the unitary is the most scrambled, and the I3 is the absolute value of I3 is the maximum. Basically, it depends on the number of qubits in area A. So this is something very interesting to actually see in a quantum neural network. Because let's say you want to do the quantum information processing to do something to read out one classical bit of information from a state. If you view this quantum circuit from left to right, you are doing machine learning. You actually extract some information into this readout qubit. But if you view it in the opposite way, because I mean, in the end, it's a unitary transformation. Nothing prevents you from viewing the process from left to, from right to left. So actually, the thing what is happening is that the information in this readout qubit scrambles back to the whole system. So it actually makes sense to compute the tripartite information, ACD, where A is this readout qubit, and CD is some region you by your choice in the input.
So when you right, left, you consider before or after measurement?
So so everything before the measurement.
Okay.
So actually, so this A is here. It's right before the measurement. So basically, I want to say is what we will see in the following is how does tripartite information change during the training process of this quantum neural network. So the task is the very artificial man-made task. It's magnetization learning. So what we want to learn is the wave function and total magnetization pairs. So the input data is the ground state wave function of this very random, long-ranged Ising model. And the output is the magnetization of this this ground state. And we want to minimize the we want the readout to be this. In the end, we want the readout and the expectation value of the readout to be the same as the magnetization of that ground state. So in other words, we want to train a network to actually do this non-local measurement for us. And we train that using a classical gradient descent algorithm numerically in the computer, not in a classical computer. Yeah, it's 1D. But it actually, because this interaction is all to all, and it does not decay, it's basically sampled from a random uniform distribution. Which parameters? All Jij, Kij, Jij, H, they are all random.
So can it add it just positive or can it be positive and negative?
So apart from a parameter which is positive, this H is a pinning field to mimic the symmetry breaking. All other parameters can either be positive or negative. So actually it's not really 1D because the interaction is all to all. It's so this is the result. So basically we find that the loss function is actually very expected. It decreases monotonically during the training. However, the tripartite information here, this I3 tripartite information is exactly this AC. So basically, A is the readout just before the measurement of the readout qubit. C is half of the whole system in the middle. So we find that the behavior of I3 is very non-monotonic. It actually first increases, then decreases. And this behavior is actually quite robust in different tasks and in different algorithms. You can try different grid descent algorithms. It all looks like that. So what is happening in this two-stage learning behavior? So to understand the first stage, we actually keep track of the two-point correlation function throughout the training process. So this C2 is basically the two-point correlation function between the spin of the input and the readout qubit. And it turns out, in the end, we want the network to measure this total magnetization. So we would expect this two-point correlation function to be quite large, because in the end, you want to measure the magnetization. It turns out it indeed becomes larger. And the two-point correlation function increases very fast and at this early stage. And then it saturates, becomes featureless. So the reason why the loss function decays very fast in the first stage is basically because the network is learning the local behavior of your wave function. It basically measure, probably it is measuring two-point correlation functions and want to come up with some conclusion based on the two-point correlation function. And we also find that basically at the early stage, the tripartite information grows linearly. And the slope of linear growth depends on the learning rate of your grid descent algorithm. So, but what is happening on the late stage, the correlation function is featureless, at least two-point correlation function is featureless. And the tripartite information is decaying very rapidly. It means, so basically a decaying tripartite information means the networks becomes more scrambled. So initially, we initialize the network randomly. So basically, you are actually passing the input through a random hard unitary. So we know that it is actually very scrambled. So the initial I3 is actually very, 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 very small, very negative. So a negative I3, again, a negative I3 means the information is scrambled more strongly in the network. And actually, the early stage, the network becomes less scrambled, and the two-point correlation function increases. However, in late stage, the two-point correlation is not changing, while I3 is becomes smaller, and the network is becoming more scrambled. So to understand what is happening on the late stage, so in some sense, the result is we find that in the second stage, the network is actually learning, in some sense, they are learning the high-order correlation functions, not two-point, but three-point, four-point correlation functions. They are learning the non-local behavior of the structure of the wave function. So to see this, we actually artificially built some anti-ferromagnetic test sets. So basically, you have a domain wall. You have a domain here. We manually flip some spins such that you have actually a domain wall here. So these kind of wave functions never actually appear in your training set because we are doing we are not doing an anti-ferromagnetic icing model. So your ground state is either paramagnetic or ferromagnetic. So we want to see whether the network can learn the non-local domain wall structure of the wave function. So instead of just doing some local measurements and say, OK, this spin is pointing upwards, because the fact that the training set has a lot of ferromagnetic or paramagnetic wave functions. So if it looks like locally looks like ferromagnetic, let's say we simply guess this is a ferromagnetic wave function. So we want to say whether the we hope that the network is not actually doing that shortcut. We want to say whether the network is actually computing the magnetization. So it turns out the loss function on this human design test set, and the behavior is consistent with the behavior of I3. So when in the late stage, when the tripartite information becomes smaller, when the network becomes more scrambled, we find the network performs much better on this data set. And for the data set with larger domain size, the loss function decreases at the later stage. It basically means it takes a long time and for the network to be able to learn the to capture the domain structure in a wave function. And the larger the domain, this structure later this structure is learned during your training stage. So also actually from the you can prove that you can also view this quantum neural network from the operator growth point of view, a method that people usually a lot of quantum information physicists study. So basically, in order to under this picture, the observable you are measuring at this step and is growing by applying this unitary. So you can prove that if you want to actually accurately measure this magnetization, that operator needs to be very non-local. It needs to be it needs to cover basically all this. You need a chain of non-local poly operators in order to capture the total magnetization. So the summary of second part is, and we find that in this, we basically monitor the how tripartite information, the dynamics of tripartite information in this quantum neural network training, and we find there's a two stage in this training process, and the first stage the network is building local correlation, and the late stage network is actually try to learn the global structure of the network. It actually this analogy of these two stages to the two time scales people studying many body quantum chaos, which is the dissipation time, where the 2-point correlation function becomes saturated or does not changing, and the scrambling time where the information is fully scrambled, which is reflected by the out of order time order correlation function. And there is a proof that the out of time order correlation function is related to tripartite information in the reference I mentioned before. So we believe this two this training dynamics is kind of related to this two time scales Although here, we are not actually studying quantum dynamics because the training is classical. So we hope that with this understanding, we might engineer or come up with more clever architecture of the quantum neural networks or training methods from the perspective of this quantum information scrambling. So that's all for my talk. I would like to thank my collaborators for the second part of my talk. And that's all. Thank you.
Questions?
Yeah, I'm a bit confused about the message of your second part. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So are you saying that the right to left dynamics is scrambling is a necessary condition for you to learn some global structure, some global information of the input state? Are you trying to say something like that?
Yeah. If the signature you want to learn is not local, if you simply want to learn like the magnetization of this spin, of course you don't want the information to scramble, but as long as you want to
but is this in some sense by definition, like, of course you have to
it is in some sense very trivial, of course you need to scramble, but probably we want to see in detail how is the actually things are happening, the actual dynamics of information scrambling in neural networks.
Yeah, also it's only a necessary condition, right? Because you need to tune a circuit. Like, suppose you only have a random circuit.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
It doesn't work. You need to tune it. You have data set. In some sense, it depends on your data set. If your data set is designed to be not scrambled enough, you won't see this.
All right, let's thank Hui Tao again.